It is a physical therapy day on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today. We are talking about all kinds of things, of course, as usual. We're going to be talking, to begin the show, maybe a bit about some knee pain and some research done in that area. But, of course, we will take all kinds of questions from our two guests, Jill Tide-Nissenbaum and Lori Dine-Brody. Jill, a professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW-Madison. Jill, good to see you.
It's great to be here. Hello.
And Lori, a physical therapist and athletic trainer at the UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. And Laura, good to see you.
Good to be here. And you know, Larry, every day is a physical therapy day.
Yes, it is. And it's physical therapy month. We're wrapping up
it
physical
is.
Therapy month.
Yep,
so,
yep.
Yes, every
yep.
day we're celebrating
month,
PT
day,
month.
It's
exactly.
Everything.
It is.
Right.
Well, that means if you have a physical therapy question, you can join in. And the number to call, 800-642-1234, or email to talk at WPR.org. Let's turn to knee pain for a bit. You know, it develops typically as we age.
Mm-hmm.
What's typically the cause of knee pain in older adults?
Well, typically as we age, some people will get articular cartilage changes, which result in changes in imaging on x-ray, typically osteoarthritis.
Yeah.
So that's a very common thing to have in the knee. It's the joint between the two longest levers in the body. It's a weight-bearing joint. And so it is predisposed to osteoarthritis. In addition to that, a prior injury to the knee kind of works as an accelerant to cause osteoarthritis. So, for example, we have this epidemic of ACL tears in the young athletic population. And what we know is that radiographically, 8 to 10 years after an ACL reconstruction, even if they've had their ACL reconstructed, they already show signs of arthritic changes on x-ray.
Mm.
So those kind of major insults, if you will, can actually serve as an accelerant to osteoarthritis.
I was interested in the study that mm-hmm. you brought today. I read through it. It was quite interesting to me. It looked at the claim that exercise therapy wears down the knee joint. How much truth is there to that,
Laura? All things in life, and Jill and I talk about this frequently on this show, it comes down to dosage.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there are many people who grew up with the, oh, it's wear and tear, and so I need to stop using my knee because the more I use it, the worse it'll get. I had a friend in Germany who always said, sport is mort, you know? And so, like, I don't want to exercise because I'm going to use up all my heartbeats.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing,
right.
You know? So exercise has to be dosed correctly. So, you know, if you are having symptoms of arthritis, pain, maybe some swelling, some things like that, maybe you shouldn't be playing basketball or soccer. Maybe you shouldn't be engaged in a high-speed direction change pivoting sport, but it doesn't mean you should be sitting in your Barca lounger. So figuring out the right dosage of activity for you, given your age, your joint quality, and other factors such as body mass index, strength, mobility, alignment, those things. Those are things we take into consideration when we dose.
Right. And a couple of the studies that they refer to in this paper were done on, first of all, they were done in the 70s, and they were also done on animals. So their articular cartilage is a little different. How they load is a little bit different. But one of the studies talked about how it was very detrimental to your articular cartilage, that precious cartilage we have that lines our joints. If you do kind of rapid, aggressive loading after being pretty sedentary. And, well, that's not rocket science. So
mm-hmm.
if you haven't done a marathon, I wouldn't encourage you to go run 26.2 miles without any training. But what we do know is that this tissue can adapt to load, but it has to be done appropriately, as Lori said.
Right.
But for 50 years, mm-hmm. The recommendation, I mean, people were turning to knee surgeries.
Right, exactly. And we know that the outcomes of those are not necessarily great. I mean, the classic is the meniscectomy.
Yes.
You know, many, many years ago, they used to say, oh, the only way you know that the tear was sufficiently addressed is to remove the meniscus and the meniscus regenerates. Well, the meniscus does not regenerate. What they were looking at was, because the tibial plateau was concave, like little shallow dishes, when they created bleeding and bleeding sat in the blood sat in those little shallow dishes, it formed fibrocartilage. Fibrocartilage is like the poor cousin of real articular cartilage. It doesn't last. And so later on, the call became save the meniscus at all costs.
Right.
And that's where we're at right now. We want to save the meniscus because it increases the congruency and the load transfer across the knee. So things change over time.
Correct.
As we get new information.
We have friends who had a complete meniscectomy due to a meniscal tear. Mm. And because that cushion was taken out on one side of their knee ended up in, you know, he was very knock-kneed. And then all that load goes to the other side of the knee. And that resulted for this individual in a total knee replacement. And so sparing, in this case, the meniscus as much as we can is very helpful. So now when you do have a meniscectomy, they only take out the part that is torn. They attempt to repair it if the meniscus has good blood supply. And we also know from research that just because you have a meniscal tear doesn't mean you need surgery. Conservative care works just as well. So I would say that's a really good example mm-hmm. of where the pendulum has really swung.
Right. Right, exactly. So we really encourage people to be active within the loading tolerance of their knee. And as Jill said, sudden movements mm-hmm. are the worst for your joints because you're just because of the biphasic properties of cartilage. Cartilage is slow to adapt. So if you load it quickly, then the biphasic properties don't have the opportunity to work and you can damage your knee.
One of the things that I near the conclusions of it was that exercise therapy is considered medicine mm-hmm. for at least 26 chronic conditions, of which most are occurring in patients with osteoarthritis.
That is true. If you look how many musculoskeletal conditions as well as other conditions are treated, one of the recommendations is exercise. And I think that's so important that we discuss that, but it's also the right exercise, as Lori alluded to, the right dose at the right time. And that's why you can't, if you have knee osteoarthritis and your friend Betty at the gym has knee osteoarthritis, you can't just do the same exercises that Betty does and expect to have a good outcome because every person is very individual.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
So we have questions, lots of questions online already, and here's one that relates, Karen and probably then Kim, but Karen, we'll go to you in Baraboo. Hi, Karen.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for your show, Larry. I listen whenever I can, and Bill and Lori, I just want to say that physical therapists are the unsung heroes in the healthcare system, as far as I'm concerned.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
I have had posterior right knee pain. I injured it running 5 years ago and went to PT, did the strengthening and exercises and balance. And I've gone two other times because it flares once in a while. The back of my knee is where the mm-hmm. pain starts, but when there's a flare, it's the whole knee is painful. It doesn't want to bend all the way. It doesn't want to straighten all the way.
Mm-hmm.
And my question is, judging by the symptoms, they think it's a posterior meniscus irritation.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
I'm 73 years old, so I realize there's going to be some arthritis going on in there, too. My main question is, would it be worthwhile getting imaging on the knee? Because I manage myself now when there is a flare of heat and compression, but it's taking longer and longer to recover.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Right.
So she's got a perfect case of managing really well, but also mm-hmm. some changes that are happening, you know, as we age, taking her longer to recover, things like that. So that's kind of a common mm-hmm. course we see.
Exactly. So the ultimate question is, will the imaging change your plan
of
care?
Right.
So if you are willing to investigate other level, higher level interventions besides what you've been doing and physical therapy, then getting imaging would be the appropriate next step so you know what you're dealing with. If you prefer to continue on the current trajectory that you're on, willing to accept that it's taking a little longer to recover, then imaging is not necessary because it's not going to change anything. Does that make sense?
Yeah, the meniscus, would the meniscus be involved in this?
Yes.
Yes,
yeah.
For sure.
Absolutely.
Sure. Especially yeah. with the loss of motion
right.
at and range.
Right.
So sometimes the meniscus, if you have a little tear, it can flip into mm-hmm. the joint and then flip back into position, and it can block your motion.
And it could also result in having a little Baker's cyst or a little bit of fluid
yep.
in the back of the knee
yep.
as well.
Yep.
But one of the things that Karen could do before she went down the path of a meniscectomy, Larry. Mm-hmm.
Larry, mm-hmm. uh-huh. What would you suggest, Larry?
Well, you could try StenVisc.
Yes, you could.
Oh, we cued you so well, and
right.
you got it.
Right.
Yeah.
So a StenVisc injection, which is that's the brand name for hyaluronic acid injections. We know from research that they are beneficial in the knee. That might be the first line mm-hmm. of defense prior to even going down the path of surgery.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. There are other options besides, do I have surgery or do
right.
I not have surgery for
right.
this knee? And then, so in that case, imaging would be the next step.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. Two or three shots mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. there you go.
Correct. Yeah. Yep.
And 10 years later, it'll be Larry and still mm-hmm. golfing and running.
Yep. Yep. Exactly. So, yeah, let us know what you decide, Karen.
Yeah. Thank you very much for calling. Kim and Eau Claire will get to you. Hi, Kim.
Hi, ladies. Hi, Larry. I spoke to you guys probably over a year ago about having my baby toe amputated.
I remember this.
I did.
Oh, okay.
You did.
Okay.
It's tomorrow will be a month and a half since the surgery.
Okay.
And what I did see for a follow-up with the doctor after the surgery, he said, look good. But I'm concerned down at the lower part where the callus or the bottom of the foot lap of skin is kind of sticking out like claw. And I don't know if this is in your wheelhouse or not, as far as knowing how long it takes for skin to atrophy and flatten out, and if that bump is going to go away. I do have another follow-up with him on the 29th of this month about that extra skin. I don't know if you guys know anything about that.
So let me ask you this. Are you wearing a regular shoe, and are you walking normally, or are you still using an assistive device? Tell us about that.
No, I'm walking normally. Yesterday, I mowed the lawn, I fertilized, I edged.
Okay.
Of course you did.
Where is this flap of skin relative to where you had your surgery?
It's at the furthest, lowest point, if you're standing, if I'm standing looking at my foot standing, it's the furthest out tip towards where.
So the bottom,
the toe.
Where the toe used to be. So
okay.
It's probably the end of the metatarsal.
Right. Could be.
Yeah.
It'd definitely be worth asking your physician about. It shouldn't be weight bearing. You shouldn't, as you roll through, it shouldn't be pushing.
Yeah. No,
it.
You shouldn't be.
Because you're going to be more in your great toe.
Yeah, well, it'll go across the metatarsal head,
right.
So it shouldn't go out the end of the little toe. So
correct.
I would think that is going to resolve over the next several months.
It'll remodel,
but I would ask your physician if you're concerned about it. But
absolutely.
Apparently it doesn't seem to be impairing your activities of daily living.
Right.
Yeah. So ask the doctor, but I don't see anything that strikes me as highly unusual about it at this point.
And can you remind us why, I remember you calling in and talking about this, can you remind us why you elected to have this done in the first place? Was it pain? Was it, I can't remember, Kim.
So I had a deformed toe, so the second metatarsal joint was, instead of going up and down, it went sideways, and that bone linked on top of the fourth toe.
Yes. Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. Okay.
Yeah. All right. Kim, there you go. See your doc and ask your questions. Appreciate it very much.
Yeah, thanks for the follow-up. Yeah. We love to hear back from people.
Right.
Lori Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Bissenbaum, our guests today. I'm Larry Mueller. We're talking physical therapy here on WPR News. Coming up at 12:30 today, we'll talk with a blacksmith who's been creating art out of metal for more than 30 years. Looking forward to that. In the meantime, we're looking at physical therapy issues with our UW physical therapist, Lori Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum. And we'll take another call. Ellen in La Crosse, it's your turn. Ellen, thank you for calling.
Hi. I fell off my bike on June 6th and landed pretty much directly on the lateral aspect of my left knee. Since that time, I saw an orthopod a month later, got one injection. He did extensive exams and felt my knee was structurally sound. It has continued to progress very slowly. But walking, my favorite activity, is still, I feel like my gait has changed. I have seen a physical therapist two times or three times, and we addressed like tightness in my calf. So I'm working and pain in my calf, the top of my calf, like my gastroc, I think, and my soleus.
Are
so both of those are tight, and actually that was where the focus of the pain was. Post injection, the pain persisted in that muscle area. So now I'm able to walk. I walked a mile and a half this morning, but not really at pace, and my gait feels odd. My hip flexor seems like it's getting a little tighter. My knee doesn't seem like it can come all the way into full extension, like hyperextend, like you push back.
Mm-hmm.
It's gotten slowly better, and that has been the answer every time that I've talked to anybody, like, oh, you have effusion, and it's going to get better. But it has. But now I think I'm seeing changes that are becoming chronic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you are.
Absolutely. Yeah. So what did the physician inject when you had your injection?
He injected anti-inflammatory and local.
Okay.
So I got immediate relief with the local. I did have some pain in my knee, got immediate relief with the local, and then the anti-inflammatory he said would work over a period of time. And I think it did. And the pain isn't specifically focused in my knee, although my range of motion has become, I think it's, I can't flex past, I don't know. I can't flex as far as my other knee.
But you didn't have any imaging. So the physician thought that everything was structurally sound, but still gave you an injection. Did you do any imaging?
Never. No.
Okay. It's sounding like posterolateral corner, posterior meniscus-y, if there's something that's blocking her flexion.
Right, and swelling.
And unable to fully extend during gait. And there was actually an interesting study that just came out that talked about how working with somebody's gait can decrease your arthritis symptoms if you have arthritis. So gait is a really important aspect of arthritis. So it's been long enough since June that you should be getting better. Jill has got a furrowed brow.
I'm curious if the physician you saw was a primary care physician or if it was an orthopod.
She said an orthopedic.
He was a pediatric PA. Orthopedic PA.
Okay.
Orthopedic PA.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you saw an ortho PA. Okay.
Mm-hmm. But at that time, it was fairly acute.
Correct.
You know, and so how your knee looked acutely, and then with the injection you got better, seemed like you were on the right track. And you went to PT, which is perfect. And, you know, working on some of that tightness makes sense, but you're still not getting where you need to be. I think you need to go back, and they need to have another look at the status of your knee today because, right. you know, if you had limited range when the PA saw you the first time, that might be acceptable in an acute injury. But you are now in the subacute slash chronic
phase.
4 months,
yes.
And you should not still have limited motion and should not be having gait changes. So I think it's time to go back for another look.
She's coming up on 4.5, 5
yeah.
months.
Yep.
So it's
yeah.
time.
Yep. Yep.
It's time.
Yeah.
Time to go.
Yeah, I go back and have it looked at again.
Yes.
And thank you very much for calling. Good luck. Let us know how that turns out.
Yeah.
Susie in Stevens Point, we'll go to you. Hi, Susie.
Hi. Thanks so much for taking my call. Quick question. I have been diagnosed with radiculopathy in the SIL4L5 area, nerve root stenosis, I guess, technically, or casually called. no surgical fix, nothing that is, surgically repairable or improvable. Looking for answers, daily routine. I'm working with an excellent physical therapist. Any suggestions with regard to how to increase that cerebrospinal flow out of that region?
So is it foraminal stenosis or is it central stenosis, Susie?
Oh, it's foraminal, definitely.
Oh, okay, great.
Yeah. And you're working with an excellent physical therapist, so I would say you've checked all the right boxes. So because that person has examined you and started you on a rehab program, I mean, that's where I would go. So this is a problem that is definitely solvable with physical therapy. Do you know what started it off?
You know, there's multiple things. I'm a cancer patient. I've had chemotherapy. I'm over 70. I ride horses competitively.
Oh, jeez.
Good for you.
Is it one-sided, Susie, or is it both sides?
You know, it is bilateral.
Okay. Because right. sometimes you can do some unilateral activities to open up one foramen, but then you're closing the other foramen. So then you
right,
have to think
right,
about
exactly.
those things. So, yeah,
exactly.
something with a big flexion bias.
Mm-hmm. How do you do on the horse?
Right.
I went from being able to trail ride all day to being able to sit in an English saddle for about 30 minutes, meaning I had to give up my Western saddle because it really kicked off the radiating nerve pain.
It puts you in too much, you're too upright? Is that why, do you think?
Yeah, and dressage saddle as well as a more straight-legged riding position. And
oh,
that
would...
I see.
Okay. Right.
That
and
makes sense.
And dorsiflexion.
Correct.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
so,
that makes sense.
Yeah, so I guess I would be working on a lot of neural mobilization to get you into that straight-leg, ankle-dorsiflex position, because that's going to be your go-to position to get you back in the saddle, so to speak.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So back to a physical therapist?
Yeah.
She could continue to see who she is. I think, I mean, this is a little, because of your comorbidities and your history and the fact that you ride horses, this is a little more challenging, but definitely doable.
It's going to take a little bit longer.
Correct.
So that would be the take home message, because it's going to be pretty easy to annoy that nerve.
Right.
So we're going to have to hold that nerve's
hand.
Hold your horses. Yep. And take it slowly.
Right.
But I think you should get there, Susie.
Yeah, I do too.
Yeah.
And speaking of working on rehab, Nancy in Madison emailed her father waited until he was 84 to get his knees, both knees replaced, severe osteoarthritis, and should have probably had something done in his 60s. After each surgery, he quit rehab therapy after 3 weeks.
Of course he did.
He could do it on his own.
Of course he did.
But a year later, he's walking on the balls of his feet instead of heel to toe. His gait's terrible and causing hip displacement, and his balance is weak. He will not continue rehab therapy to get stronger because he hates appointments. Now he's given up using a walker and oftentimes will not use a cane. He thinks he doesn't need them anymore. Nancy thinks the anesthesia so late in life might have contributed to his poor decision-making. What's likely to happen next? A fall that sends him to a nursing home?
Yes.
Exactly. I mean, unfortunately, Nancy has nailed this.
Mm-hmm.
She's identified the gait deviations, mm-hmm. the weakness.
The balance.
She's
checked every box.
The lack of an assistive device that someone is willing mm-hmm. to use. The fact that this patient doesn't like appointments.
Yep.
Yeah, I mean, my first thought was to put him in a pool, but
clearly
he's not going to come.
You know, but he doesn't like appointments, but maybe he would join a class.
There you go.
So, you know, we have a number of older men in mm-hmm. our aquatics classes. Mm-hmm. So it's not an appointment with a provider, but maybe he would enjoy the socialization mm-hmm. of a class in the mm-hmm. pool. So mm-hmm. maybe he could go there. But yeah, no, I mean, Nancy's right. Yes, he's at very, very high risk of a fall.
Mm-hmm.
And then ending up in a nursing home. And we mm-hmm. know the 1 year mortality and hip fracture in his age group is very high.
Right.
And he's, Nancy's in Madison, so hopefully he is
as well.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Where there
yeah.
are mm-hmm. plenty yeah. of pools and opportunities.
Yeah,
absolutely. But it's hard with a stubborn father.
Oh, yeah.
So
we know about
we
that.
We know about that, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
yeah.
And mother.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
Let's move on to Tom. Tom in Green Bay will give you a chance to join in. Hi, Tom.
Hello. Yeah, very timely conversation. I'm having a knee scope tomorrow.
Oh, great.
MRI said I have a macerated meniscus tear.
Mm.
And my knee is stiff all the time. It's just not getting better. Should I go forward with it?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if it's disabling you as much as it is, and it's shown up on imaging, a meniscectomy that spares your meniscus as much as it can, in other words, a very capable surgeon who's only going to take out the minimum amount of your meniscus, followed by really good rehab, which is really going to be important for you, Tom.
Mm-hmm.
The one thing you have to think about is when you have a meniscectomy, the rest of the meniscus takes load differently. And so part of the rehab process is training the rest of the meniscus how to take that additional and different load. And so unlike Nancy's dad, we need you to be compliant mm-hmm. with your rehab and make sure you do everything and see a physical therapist relatively soon after your meniscectomy, within the week.
Just mm-hmm. think about Nancy's 84-year-old dad every time you...
Yeah,
correct.
See if you want to be walking around on the balls toes. Of your feet. Yeah.
Good luck, Tom. Thank you for calling. Lee in Green Bay, it's your turn. Hi, Lee.
Yeah, hi. Approximately about a month and a half ago, I was doing a brake job on my truck, crawling underneath there. And I was, you know, fighting with an impact wrench. I did something to my shoulder. I saw a physical therapist a little over a week ago. She did her measurements and what my, you know, my, how I can move here and there and whatever. My question is, my arm, I can't really, it's my right arm and I can't really lift it by itself, let's call it that way.
Mm-hmm. These are your muscles.
Up to my shoulder. From there, I get weak, and I can't lift it any higher. If I flip it up, I can do it. I have no pain, but
if you flip it up,
weak.
What does that mean?
Like throw it up in the air?
Like
throw
swing it?
Throw it up in the air.
Throw it up in the air. So tell me the impact wrench, what happened? How did this happen? It kicked back, or?
I was laying underneath here. You know, the truck is up on jack stands.
Yep.
I'm crawling underneath there to get over the leaf springs. I've got this impact wrench.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of twisting around under there.
Yeah.
And next thing you know, that hurts.
Ah, so he had like a torque of some
mm-hmm.
sort. So so he could have mm-hmm. irritated his rotator cuff. Is my
he could
best
have torn
guess.
His
he could have
rotator
torn
cuff.
His rotator
mm-hmm.
cuff. Right?
How old are you, Lee?
77.
Oh.
Shoot.
It's not funny, though.
Shoot. It's not funny. It's funny how we did that just at the same time. You'd think we were related.
So we know that as the rotator cuff ages, it becomes more fibrotic. It doesn't have as much water, and it is at risk for a tear, which is kind of goes along those lines you talked about, Lee, that you can't raise your arm using your muscle
mm-hmm.
overhead,
mm-hmm.
but you can flip it up there, basically passively.
Mm-hmm.
So have you seen a physical therapist? Have you seen anyone else for this?
No, just about a week, little, I think it was over a little over a week and a half ago I saw her, okay. As I said.
Are you, do you have pain?
I was going to say, do you have any,
do you have
pain?
Any pain?
No.
Oh.
Well, there you go.
Could be a complete rotator cuff tear.
Could be a complete rotator cuff tear.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. So there, this is not a surgical case.
Not a rotator cuff repair.
Not a rotator cuff repair at this point. And you're not having pain. If you saw a physician, they're going to tell you to go to physical therapy. So you continue with that and you see how far the other muscles in your shoulder can take over for your rotator cuff.
Right. Exactly. So, there are many people walking around with complete rotator cuff tears who function just fine and don't even know they have rotator cuff tears. You can get a degenerative tear and people walk around and have no clue that they have a rotator cuff tear.
Right.
So you can get by without it. So I would definitely work with that physical therapist closely to make sure that you can do all the activities you want to do, continue crawling under cars at age 77.
Exactly. But so it's going to be slow going because these other muscles are going to have to do double duty.
Right.
They're going to have to figure out how to compensate for the lack of a rotator cuff, and your physical therapist should be working with you to work through that process. And you may end up making some modifications. So, for example, instead of raising your arm straight forward in front of you, you might bend your elbow and then send your arm straight up like you're punching the ceiling. Mm-hmm. Shorten that lever arm to make it a little easier. So there are some adaptations that will help you to get through.
Right.
Good luck, Lee. Thank you very much for calling. Let's turn to Claire in Sauk County. Hi, Claire.
Hi, Larry. I'd like to ask the sisters their philosophy on pain. I saw a young man this summer. He was wearing a T-shirt that said, "Pain is weakness.
Leaving your body." Oh.
Yes. We've seen that T-shirt.
Yeah.
I had a conversation with him. I said, "Where did you get that?" Well, guess what? He was going into boot camp in a few weeks.
Yeah.
And I said, "Oh, boy."
Yeah. Yeah, that's a totally different thing. So, you know, people will show up and they'll say, "Well, you know, nope." I say, "Here, do this exercise." And I'll ask them if it hurts and they say, "Well, no pain, no gain." You know, that's fine if you're a bodybuilder in the gym and you're working through some fatigue as you work and do heavy lifting. It is not appropriate in rehab.
And I think there's a difference between pain, muscle pain. Fatigue, because I've lifted so many weights, versus joint pain, which is entirely different. We don't want that joint pain. So I like train, don't strain, as a good motto. You're training things, but you don't want to overdo them. So our philosophy is pain is your body's way of telling you something is wrong.
So, you know, a lot of times I'll see people who haven't exercised in a long time. And when they come back, they'll say, "I had pain, but it wasn't the pain that brought me here. I had pain because I hadn't exercised like that before." So that's the typical delayed onset muscle soreness that you get with a new activity.
Correct.
And that's a great to be point. Expected.
Right. That's a great
to be
point,
expected.
Laura.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So does that answer your question, Claire?
We've already
centered a boot camp. Yeah.
Okay.
Tom, let's go to Tom in Minocqua instead. Tom, hello.
Good morning. Thanks, everybody. The mechanic, 77-year-old mechanic, I feel kind of wimpy even asking.
Go ahead, Tom.
Okay, thanks, Larry. Last February, March, I was at a party with some friends, and I described for them this pain that I've been having on my right side. I didn't even know what to call it. I showed them where the pain was, and they said, "You're going to need hip replacement." And so this goes on for a while, and then this summer I went to I went to a chiropractor. Placement seemed a bit extreme. He gave me some exercises to do that worked somewhat, but still the pain was persisting and becoming a little, you know, where I just wasn't doing some things I wanted to do because of this pain. So I went to a physician assistant at a bone and joint clinic, and he did x-rays and stuff and said, "Well, there was no need for replacement." But he told me to continue to do the exercises and gave me a prescribed a medication that starts with an M that I can't remember, but I think it's pretty
Meloxicam.
Common for these things.
Meloxicam, yeah.
And okay. It seems to work, but not always. So let me, Saturday.
Uh-oh, another party?
I was just, well, another party, No, but like bending over to get stuff out of the dishwasher or getting up from a chair, and it was just giving out on me quite a bit on Saturday afternoon.
Okay.
Saturday night, I walked 5 miles and no pain or anything.
So let's roll the tape back here. So these friends that you were showing the friends at the party in February, were they medical professionals?
Well, one is a physical therapist, and one okay. has had knee and hip replacement.
Oh, so they're okay. an expert.
Okay, all right, right, exactly. Okay.
So the person you haven't seen so far sounds like a physical therapist. So you've gotten some exercises from a chiropractor, and you've gotten exercises from the physician assistant. What I haven't heard him see is a physical therapist to get prescribed exercises who's looked at something beyond his hip.
Well, and he's also said right side, like right side where?
Right, on your hip, on your butt, on your back. Where'd he go?
Yeah. It's not my butt or my back.
It's not your butt or your back. It's definitely your hip.
Outside of your hip, like where you lay on it?
No, I have no pain at when I'm... No, not like that. No.
Okay.
Related, I think.
Okay, so it's deep in the joint on the outside. So you can't palpate or touch
okay.
it. Okay.
Could be a labral tear.
It could
FAI.
Be a labral tear. It could still mm-hmm. be referred from the back.
So it could be referred from the back.
I mean, mm-hmm. that's where the back mm-hmm. refers.
Yeah. So. Yep. Yep. Exactly. So there are a couple suspects on that list, but yeah, I would. Yeah, not a hip replacement. It doesn't mm-hmm. sound hip. Primary hip pain is usually groin. So if you're hurting on the outside, I start looking elsewhere right away.
Yeah.
So I would get in to see a PT and have somebody do a thorough exam, including your back, mm-hmm. because this could all be coming from your
Correct.
Back.
I agree.
And the deeper the pain, the harder it is to isolate the source of it.
Right. But yeah, specific exercises for you prescribed mm-hmm. by a physical therapist I think would be helpful.
Yeah.
Tom, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Looking at physical therapy kinds of issues today with our two guests, Lori Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. Tomorrow on the show, we'll talk with the hosts of the radio talk show, Away With Words, one that I love that show. Then we get an update on the cranberry industry, and we'll hear all about making pizza from a West Alice restaurant owner. All that tomorrow. Right now, we're taking a look at all kinds of physical therapy issues with Lori Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum, our physical therapists from the UW University of Wisconsin. It's great to have them back with us as they come by every month to talk with you and with me. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Or you could email to talk@wpr.org. Let's take a call from Sheila in Eau Claire next. Hi, Sheila.
Hi, Larry. I've enjoyed your show for decades. So
thank you.
I hope you stay on for a long time yet. My question is, I have pain in my left knee. Maybe about 5 years ago, my GP kind of told me I had arthritis in my knees, like when I squatted down to unload the dishwasher or something, I had pain. Now it seems to have gotten worse, more on the inside of my left knee. And sometimes, I'm not sure what they're called, but the big muscles or something on the back of the knee seems to be tighter. My question is, who do I see first? Do I go back to my GP or do I make an appointment with a physical therapist or what do I do?
So those are great questions, and I'm glad since you've seen these changes and you're kind of declining a little bit, it's definitely time to get in and see someone. In the state of Wisconsin, you do not need a referral to see a physical therapist. So you can see a PT without a referral. Having said that, there are many insurance companies, including Medicare, that require a referral or pre-authorization, something along those lines, prior to seeing a physical therapist. So I guess you need to start with whatever kind of your insurance recommends, but you definitely need to see a physical therapist. It sounds like your hamstrings are getting tight in the back, probably protecting your knee. It's not uncommon for you to get pain on the inside of your knee with arthritic changes, because we do have a tendency to load the medial side of our joint a wee bit more than the lateral side.
Just a little clarification on the Medicare physical therapist.
Please.
Can see the patient for an evaluation. They cannot treat
them
until the physician signs the plan
That's
of care document that the physical therapist sends. So you can go see the physical therapist and be evaluated. The physical therapist will then send that plan of care to your physician. When the physician signs off, they can begin treatment.
There you go.
Yeah.
There you go, Sheila. Thank you so much for calling. Jim and Ephraim emailed, avid biker, bikes 15 to 20 miles 5 or 6 times a week, and no issues from that. However, when he walks, even after just a quarter mile, he has low back pain. It's not radiating down either leg. He thinks his gait is off as well. Jim recently had an x-ray at his wellness check, and he has mild arthritis in the lowest lumbar vertebrae. He'd like to get back to walking as well as biking. He does have an initial evaluation with a PT at the end of the month. Jim's doctor also said he might be a candidate for an ablation procedure and wonders what that procedure involves.
So, well, if I lived in Ephraim, I'd be biking 15 to 20 miles a day as well, because it's beautiful up there in Door County. So my best guess is, and we talked a little bit about this during the break, is biking probably puts Jim in a little bit of flexion, which makes him feel better, and walking puts his spine in a little bit of lumbar extension. So my best guess is there's a directional preference for Jim to be in flexion.
Yes, and I think he needs to see a physical therapist,
which
and he's got an appointment, and they will work with him.
Mm-hmm.
My guess is he's got a little tightness in his hip flexors because he's a biker, and he's in a forward flex position. And so when he goes into extension, his low back says, what the heck?
Right.
You know, I didn't sign up for this. So he needs to work with a physical therapist and improve that mobility in his lumbar spine. And I don't think he'll need an ablation.
Correct.
And ablation is a fairly significant surgical procedure.
Correct.
Where they go in and basically,
Roto-rooter.
Yeah, and sever the nerve. So.
Right. He would benefit. So if it truly is that, he might benefit from uphill walking or on a treadmill with an incline or in the pool. All of those things would definitely be lower hanging fruit that would be good options for Jim.
There's so many ways you could go to help treat this problem for Jim that are far short of having any kind of surgical procedure.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Even changing his bike to one that would give him a more upright position.
Yep.
Maybe.
Potentially.
That's also a possibility.
Yeah,
you're right.
Yeah, yeah. But I would start with structured activities that move into extension in a controlled fashion to get his back used to being and working in that range. And sometimes doing it in a pool is great because you don't have gravity. But working with the PT should get him where he needs to go.
Ted in Spooner has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Ted.
Yeah, hello. Well, I had 2 knee replacements, had back surgery, and then home a day and a half, and my legs quit working. Went back in for emergency surgery, and they pulled a blood clot off the nerve. Now it's been about 2.5 years, and everything's starting to go downhill.
So your legs are what, numb?
Well, my feet are numb, and I don't know how to explain it. I can't do pick up my leg to get in the car.
Mm-hmm.
It'll only go up so high. I gotta grab my hand to pick it up.
Correct. Right.
Yeah. So it's time to go back and see the physician who did your back surgery. It sounds like there's some deterioration. What kind of surgery did they do? Do you remember when you had your back surgery?
The first one was just cut off a herniated disc.
Okay. All right.
Well, okay.
It definitely, with your two total knee replacements, there was probably some underlying weakness in the muscles due to those prior to the back surgery. And then you throw this back surgery on top of it. It's probably from some pretty significant deconditioning and weakness. So seeing a physical therapist would be very helpful. And I think seeing him, if there's a pool close by Lori, might be helpful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I also still think you should circle with your physician who did your back surgery.
Yes.
Because, you know, it's been a couple years. So are you declining, or has it been this week since your back surgery?
Well, what do you mean by declining?
So after your back surgery, did you go to therapy? Were you able to use your legs better shortly after your surgery, and now it's gotten worse, or have you been unable to lift your legs since your back surgery?
Lifting legs, I don't think has changed. Right afterwards, I'd done physical therapy and a lot of walking, and it seemed to work pretty good. Now it's starting to go the other direction.
Right. That was the question I had.
Yeah.
So the decline is what concerns me, and
right.
why I would like you to see your back surgeon again for an assessment. And I think, yeah, seeing a physical therapist to work on your strengthening and so on would be helpful. But my question is why the decline
right.
at this point.
Right. Right. Yeah.
So go make an appointment, get back in and see that person, Ted. Sherry in Colfax, hi, what's on your mind?
Hi, yes, it's my back. I had a lot of chemo and radiation, and ever since then, I have spondylolisthesis, and my L5 is broken, and now the upper three is also giving me troubles. L3, and I used to swim a lot, I mean a really lot, but ever since all this problems with the chemo and everything and the pain, I can't get in the water because it's too cold, and I'm not sure that swimming would be good for it because my shoulder is also giving me problems. I don't know if a rotator cuff was cut. The chiropractor suggested during the initial surgery for the cancer before the treatment.
Where was your cancer?
They called it breast cancer, but it was actually under behind my left arm, and it was kind of behind that, but it was underneath. So they took out, I don't know, 23 lymph nodes too down in there, so I have lymphedema.
Okay.
Yeah. So actually, a warm water pool would be a good place for you. So, you know, people who like the water do well in the water. The hydrostatic pressure will help with the lymphedema.
Yeah.
It will help with your back pain. It will allow you to be active and move. So I think getting in a warm pool where you don't have to deal with the cold would be a great activity. And you can even do, you know, deep water bicycling or things like that that are a little more active. And that would help with the lymphedema. It would help with the shoulder. It would help with the back.
Right. And you don't have to swim.
So you need to find a warm water pool.
Yeah. Yep. We see a lot of people in Research Park with who have had
Colfax,
cancer.
So Colfax is over by Milwaukee, right? Towards Milwaukee?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there should be a place there. Absolutely.
Yes. Some of those western suburbs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Sherry, there you go. And good luck. Find that warm water pool and get in it.
Right.
That's the takeaway message there. Talking today with Lori Tyne Brody. Lori's a physical therapist at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. And Jill Tyne Nissenbaum. Jill's a professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW-Madison. They come by once a month to talk with us about physical therapy issues, and then they will be staying with us right up till 12:30 today. So you stay with us. We'll be back right after this look at the news, and we'll be finding out what else is in store for us here on WPR News. I'm Larry Mueller. Thank you. It's another physical therapy day here on WPR News. Larry Mueller, thanks for joining us. Stay with us with our physical therapists as I look across their smiling faces. Lori Tyne Brody, physical therapist and athletic trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic, and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum, Jill's a professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW-Madison. We have lots of callers online. We have some emails, so I think we'll get right to it and go to Barb in Green Bay. Barb, hello.
Hi. Hi, everybody. How's everyone doing?
We're good, doing good. Great.
Good. Packers won.
Good. Yes. Yay. I'll try and be as brief as I can. I'm 70 years old. I had a torn meniscus probably 10 years ago that they removed a good portion of it when they used to do that.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And then I had stem cell in that knee, which was very beneficial for me at the time. And I also contracted Lyme disease 4 years ago, late stage Lyme. And so I'm pretty sure I have the knee Lyme arthritis in my knees. And my question is, I've had x-rays, and I'm always keeping an eye on the knee without most of the meniscus. And I'm not bone on bone yet, but I have two questions. And one is, what am I supposed to feel when you're thinking arthritis versus bone on bone? And the other question is, can I still have arthritis if I get a knee replacement?
So the bone on bone is just extreme form of arthritis, for lack of better terms. There's a grading system that physicians use, and there's 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, and basically 4 alludes to you've lost all of your joint space between the two bones, and that would be bone on bone arthritis. That's kind of what we say.
So typically the meniscus sits in between the two bones.
Right.
So you have, you know, your tibia, then you have meniscus that provides a spacer, if you will. It's mostly a spacer. And then you have the femur. So if you have bone on bone, it means that you've lost both the articular cartilage and the meniscus that sits between the two bones. So it is advanced stage osteoarthritis. And so
can I go ahead. Before you answer the second question. So there also, we know at multiple joints, there's not necessarily a correlation between what we see on plain films and how you function. So there's people walking around with what, quote unquote, bone on bone arthritis who function just fine. There's people who have maybe stage 1 OA and their pain is significant. So, you know, it's one factor we take into consideration when we evaluate our patient, but most importantly, it's how you're functioning when you're sitting in front of us. So we don't want to label our patients with bone-on-bone arthritis or things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah,
that's
there's zero correlation mm-hmm. between imaging and a patient's symptoms. So.
Right.
And so the question comes up about a knee replacement.
Yeah, right. Can you still have arthritis if you have a knee replacement? I mean, technically, no.
No, because you don't have the tissues that are arthritic, become arthritic.
Yeah,
because
right.
you have components, metal components in there, that metal and plastic components that replace that.
Mm-hmm. So this may be a good thing?
Let me back up. There are people who have knee replacements who still have a lot of pain.
Right, right.
And
the pain comes from
mm-hmm.
something else, just not the arthritis.
Yeah, exactly.
Stiffness.
People think about the bones, but there's a lot of other tissues there.
Mm-hmm.
There's ligaments, there's joint capsule, there's synovial fluid, there's fascia. There's all kinds of connective tissue there
right.
that can be pain generators.
Right.
And that may be partially explaining why there's very little correlation between imaging and symptoms.
Right.
So, yes, you can have a knee replacement and still have pain. Is it technically arthritis pain? No, but
probably
it's
not.
Coming from somewhere.
All right. Barb, does that help?
I think so. It's kind of a crapshoot, I think.
Yeah,
you gotta
think long and hard about it.
Right. Yeah,
exactly.
And
yeah.
Basically, we tell people, you know, when they come and ask me, when should I get a knee replacement? And my answer is always when the bad days are winning. You know, when your world has gotten small because you stop doing things because your knee hurts or you just can't do them and it's impacting your lifestyle, that's the time you think about it.
I just had coffee yesterday with an orthopedic surgeon has had a total knee replacement. She's about a year out. And her comment to me was, I wish I would have done it sooner. I didn't realize the little lifestyle changes that I had compromised on because they were such small little bites until she had her total knee replacement and realized, like, oh, I can do these things. And when was the last time I did that? And she just didn't, it was such a gradual decline for her that she didn't realize the dramatic change.
Mm. That's a classic. Right. It's like the frog in the pot of boiling water, right?
Yeah.
Barb, there you go. Think about it and let us know how you decide. Thank you very much for calling. James in Madison, your turn. Hi, James.
Hello there.
What can we do for you?
I started donating plasma and donated probably maybe 80 times between 24 and early 25. And I developed a problem with my right arm, which is the exclusive place where I give the plasma. And I don't know, I've heard that maybe there's no effect of plasma donation or that there's might be a development of scar tissue there. And it's been a persistent pain that is worse overnight, that tends to loosen up during the day. And it's either that or, that's the same hand I use when I swipe on my phone as I'm scrolling. But it's a twisting and turning motion that gives me the pain. And it seems to be very persistent. So two questions. Have the guests had any experience with scar tissue related to plasma donation and risks or needs for physical therapy with that? Or in addition, a scrolling, like your phone use pain?
Yeah.
Right. Those are great questions. So, James, is your pain in the front of your elbow where they would put the needle in for the plasma donation?
There's kind of a weakness in that arm that I never experienced prior to plasma donation, but there's also a very distinct pain, like with a twisting motion on the top of my forearm in that muscle that is on the top of just ahead of my elbow on the top.
And where's the injection?
The supinator.
The injection?
It's pretty much in the crook of your elbow. On the outside of the not right in the middle.
You know, so in answer to your first question, no, I have not had that. I've not experienced anyone who's come in with pain related to plasma donation. I mean, my thought is the plasma donation is pretty superficial. I mean, they look for those vessels that you can see. So it's not like they're digging through a lot of muscle tissue for the plasma donation.
Right. But if you get poked, did he say 80 times?
Yeah, 80 times.
So
yeah.
Could you lay down some scar tissue in adjacent structures?
Right.
Maybe.
Maybe.
Maybe. It's highly possible.
But so it makes me wonder if it's somewhere in the biceps.
Supinator. Biceps or the supinator.
Or the biceps, too.
Either of those.
So it could be either of those.
Yeah.
So the bottom line is you need someone to take a look at it. And there are a few muscles that turn you from palm down to palm up in your forearm, and those typically happen up pretty close to your elbow.
Right.
So having somebody do an assessment of those muscle groups to see if they are the pain generator or if it's some scar tissue in the area, it would direct the treatment. One's going to be directed toward the muscles and the other's going to be directed toward the scar tissue.
Right.
We can't tell you which one it is.
Right.
So
no,
you
but
need
I was,
somebody to look
yeah,
at it.
Someone
yeah,
someone to take a look
Absolutely.
At it. It's a good question. So let us know.
Yeah, it's a,
yeah,
great,
that's
a,
it's
great
a new
question.
One. Yeah.
And
a
physical therapist, are
yeah,
you
yeah,
saying?
Yeah, yeah, yeah,
sure.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
Musculoskeletal experts there.
James, good luck. Thank you for calling. Alute in River Falls, what's on your mind?
Oh, hi. This is a very, I'm just so glad that I tuned in to you today, I'll put it that way. I got knee pain, tremendous knee pain, about 2 days after I really made my knee work. I was picking peas, and the peas were at such a height and in such a way that I had to keep my knee bent all the time in order to pick these. And I was turning and twisting, and Lydney kept saying, I'm tired. And I didn't pay too much attention. The rest of it a bit. But 2 days later, oh, my goodness. And then I toughed that out for about 2 weeks, and I went to a doctor, a physician's assistant, and what she did was give me a cortisone shot. And that worked for about 6 weeks. But in order to get a second one, I have to go 12 weeks. Well, the pain was really, really getting pretty bad. So I got steroid. Now, that has modified the pain tremendously. But and I asked, what do I do from now on? They said, well, knee replacement. Well, this was a physician's assistant. So that seems to be drastic to me.
Mm-hmm. It is a little drastic.
It's a big step. So I have to say, I think this is our very first pee-picking injury.
I would say it's our very first pee-picking mm-hmm. injury, but it sounds very like an arthritic meniscal tear to me, mm-hmm. like in a white area mm-hmm. with some degenerative changes right. in that back of the knee. Yeah.
And some patellofemoral.
For sure.
Probably
yeah.
if she's in a squatting position
Correct.
And torquing.
Correct.
So the reason some of the pain may have gone away is because they dealt with the primary tibiofemoral stuff, but she could still have some patellofemoral
right.
stuff.
Well, and she could still have, yeah, she could yeah. still yeah. have.
So what does she do?
She needs to see a physical, yeah, so physical therapist. There are many, many options between
yes.
getting an injection and having a knee replacement. As we said earlier, I think when Barb called, is there's very little correlation between imaging. If the PA took x-rays and said, oh, you have arthritis, so you need a knee replacement, very little correlation between imaging and symptoms. But symptoms like you have resolve very nicely in most people with appropriate physical therapy. So
right.
I would request a physical therapy referral
mm-hmm.
before I ever contemplated a knee replacement.
Any surgery. Any surgery on your knee.
Yep, exactly.
Lute, good luck. Thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Kath in Winchester, your turn. Hi, Kath.
Hi, how are you?
Good, appreciate the call.
First of all, I want to say I think physical therapists are completely undersung. People don't know how good they are. They're wonderful.
Well,
I've been
thank
three
you.
Times.
Thank you.
Perfect results. And just with a simple exercise here or there. But I've always exercised. I'm quite elderly, but I still bike and kayak in the summer, and I was a skier mainly, so I still downhill and cross country. I won't tell you how old I am till the end. So,
everyone will stay tuned.
Yes.
Yeah, it seems to get in the way. My friends all think I'm a 7-day wonder or something. They keep saying, I hope I'm like you when I grow up.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway. If one more says it, I might hit him. But anyway, a friend of mine asked about back pain. I said, well, I've had lower back pain, solved that, and I had a deep, deep pain, back pain in the middle, and the masseuse couldn't even touch it. It was very deep. And so my trainer turned me on to Peter Ogoscue's pain-free exercises, which solved it completely. After a month and a half, I've never had that pain ever since. And I said, do yoga for the back, low back pain, and try Peter Ogoscue's pain-free exercises for the if it's deep, deep down and you can't get at it.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to make sure I wasn't telling them wrong. It worked for me.
So the Ogoscue method is another method for mobility and flexibility focused primarily on the low back. It's, you know, kind of in the same category as yoga. There would be positions that might be helpful for a patient and other positions where we may not recommend it. So it's one of those treatment techniques that it gets you moving and gets you mobile and tries to stretch you in the appropriate direction. It's just making sure that it's the direction, things that they're doing are appropriate for you. So you still got to customize it a bit.
Mm-hmm. So you bring up some good points. And, you know, this is a program that's available to the public, just mm-hmm. like yoga. Or mm-hmm. many times patients will go to their physician and they'll say, just walk. Mm-hmm. And there is a certain segment of the population that improves with exercise of any kind.
Correct.
Any kind will improve. Some people will get better, and hallelujah, because there's enough people in the medical system already. So if you can get better with things that like walking or yoga or things many people have called and have done a good job self-managing their symptoms,
right.
That's great. If you can't, you need to see somebody
right.
so that we can help fine-tune or tailor the exercise program to your specific needs. Because for some reason, just walking or yoga or Pilates or whatever it is isn't working for you.
Right. Yeah. We have a PT colleague who used to say, if you have somebody with low back pain, chain them to a treadmill and eventually a lot of them will get better, which is true because it's just the overall exercise and mobility. So, mm-hmm. but mm-hmm. then, like Lori said, there's a set population where that doesn't work.
Yeah.
And Kath, how old are you?
Yeah.
I'm 94.
She can't even remember how old she is. I love it.
Love it.
Love it.
94.
Well, all right.
Thanks for making
time
to call in your busy schedule.
Yeah. And it's great that people are turning to you for advice.
Correct.
Because you are a wealth of information.
Exactly. I love it.
Thanks, Kath. Margaret in Hustisford, your turn. Hi.
Good morning, all of you. First, I want to just say that a physical therapist worked with my shoulders. Just out of the blue, they became so unable to move. And everything that she and I did just worked wonders. And I want to say that out loud. I couldn't have done it without her input. And the other now is about my dog. I gave her an injection 3 weeks ago of the hyaluronic acid. She tore her, what we call the ACL or the CCL on the dog. And I began thinking, this could work with my knees. So I'm talking about hyaluronic. And how do I get it? Where do I go? How do I begin? And I just want to say that my knees, I'm now only going up and down the stairs one step at a time. So I'm just affected my balance. It seems all soft tissue related. I don't have motion. The ligaments are so tight, tendons. And it hurts, of course, to stretch. And I'm 79.
So hyaluronic acid injections are indicated in people typically have an intra-articular pathology, so some changes within the joint itself, whether it's within your meniscus or your articular cartilage or something along those lines. They are performed by physicians. Primary care, mm-hmm. ortho, anyone mm-hmm. can do them. And in humans, unlike dogs, it many times takes more than one injection. So they're usually staged, and you might have two, maybe three. Historically, we used to do up to five, and we're finding that most people have relief after a couple injections.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, and that's what Larry
and some people just have one.
And some people just have one. That's mm-hmm. exactly right. Larry had three, and he's been good to go for 11 years. I don't know.
At least.
Lost count.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Long time.
Yeah. He canceled his surgery.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep. So,
thanks,
yeah. So, you get your physician will do that and
make sure it's indicated for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Good luck, Margaret. Thank you. Bob in Claybanks, what's on your mind?
Hi, ladies and Larry. Thanks for the show today. I'm seeing an occupational therapist about an issue with my wrist that started off as the tennis elbow, or affected tennis elbow. And I know this might be out of your strike zone, so to speak, but I wonder, what's happened is that it's the pain has gradually worked its way to my wrist, and now it seems to be to the base of my thumb. And she did the big thumb rotation thing and no pain, so there's no thought of arthritis there. So just looking for a second opinion on what you might think be happening.
Well, I don't know that you can say there's no arthritis just
with
because you moved it around. I mean, when you have to really load the joint. I mean,
right.
kind of like you know, people with arthritis in their knees maybe don't have pain when you bend and straighten the knee, but they have pain when you load it. So it may be that you haven't sufficiently loaded your thumb to test it for that. The base of your thumb is one of the most common sites of osteoarthritis.
Right. 70% of our hand function mm-hmm. comes from our thumb. You know, the other thing could be he could have a little bit of tendinopathy. I'm almost mm-hmm. thinking like
Decoeur
a
veins.
Decoeur veins, tenosynovitis, mm-hmm. and the extensor carpi. Or extensor pollicis longus and mm-hmm. abductor pollicis brevis.
Oh, very good.
Well, I don't know where those came from. I don't know where that came from. And I'm not sure I'm right on those.
It could be the reverse.
Yeah, I think it's the reverse.
Yeah, yeah. But in any case, you know, I would expect that a hand therapist would check for those things.
Correct.
So,
sure.
And I'm wondering if some of this flared with some of the exercises that you were doing for your tennis elbow.
Could be. And the other thing is compensation, using mm-hmm. more of the thumb side of the hand if mm-hmm. they're having more issues with lateral epicondylgia. And mm-hmm. wrist pain, that there could be all sorts of accommodations that happen that could be so subtle that you don't even realize it, but with repetitive mm-hmm. motions could be doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And you're right, Lori, it's abductor pollicis longus and extensor pollicis brevis.
There you go.
So what should you be
doing? You should continue working with the occupational therapist. This is their wheelhouse.
Absolutely.
And, you know, figure out what to do. And it may be that there's a little more testing that needs to happen, a little more checking, trying some other activities. There are braces mm-hmm. you can use to support a thumb spica splint to help support the thumb during high demand activities, etc.
Right.
So continue working with your OT.
Right.
Bob, thank
Absolutely.
You very much for calling. Kent in Reedstown wonders, do you know about prolotherapy for knees? Ken thought it would have to replace his knees, but now every 6 months he gets a prolo shot and there's no problem with his knees for the last 3 years.
Hmm. We typically aren't doing prolotherapy on the knee here, and I don't know what kind he's getting, if they're taking his own blood and spinning it out and reinjecting it, or
right, if it's PRP,
or if it's mm-hmm. PRP, or what exactly it is.
Correct.
So,
because prolotherapy is kind of an overarching term for just injections.
It could
of some sort.
Sometimes they started out as saline mm-hmm. injections, and then they started taking your blood and spinning it out mm-hmm. and reinjecting. So there's a number of different versions of that. So all I can say is, you know, if you're doing well and have avoided a knee replacement, that's great. I would make sure you get into PT, because at this point, you're going in every 6 months.
That's a lot.
That's a lot. So make sure you're getting some PT and doing the rehab at the same time.
And on that note, another 90 minutes has gone
Yay,
by.
And it just flew by. Yeah, we had many great questions today.
Yeah, and
we
I'm did. Sorry we didn't get to everybody, but that's pretty much always the case.
Right.
And I want to thank you both, and we'll see you
next month.
November.
Same time,
of
same
course.
Station.
Sounds great.
Yeah.
Thanks,
great time.
Thank you so much. Jill Tyne-Nissenbaum, professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW-Madison. One of our guests, and Lori Tyne Brody, of course. Lori, a physical therapist, athletic trainer at University of Wisconsin Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. Great to have them with us, and they'll be back in almost exactly 1 month, and we will do this all over again. Coming up next, we'll talk with a blacksmith who's been creating art out of metal for more than 30 years. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News.
And it's sparks are flying, passion strong. I am the blacksmith singing the hammer and the anvil song. I thought to make an anchor.
Okay, song is titled Hammer and Anvil from The Longest Johns. A good way to get us into our final segment of the day as we talk blacksmithing. You know, there are a lot of benefits to working with your hands. You feel accomplishment. It provides a sense of calm. And if you're crafty or handy, you might be nodding your head right now. Larry Mueller here, talking about one way to work with your hands at extremely hot metal. It's called blacksmithing. And James Michael Jones is with us now. He's been a blacksmith for more than 30 years. He owns and operates a custom shop on the Bayfield Peninsula. And as we talk with James, I hope you will join in. Do you have questions about working in a skilled trade? Do you have blacksmith experience? If you work in the trades already, would you recommend it to others? Why or why not? Give us a call. The number 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. James Michael Jones, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Hi. Yeah, well, thanks for taking time to have us on.
You know,
it's an honor to be with you.
Well, it's great to have you with us. I was thinking back on this. When I was a kid, you know, I was raised on a farm near Cottage Grove, Wisconsin. There was a blacksmith shop in Cottage Grove, and I think the guy's name was Gus Dukert. And when we had a problem on the farm with a hitch, maybe, that broke, it would go to Gus, and Gus would fix the darn thing.
Right.
And that's the traditional way of blacksmithing. What is blacksmithing to you?
Oh, wow, yeah. It's a lot. It's a lot about that. It's a lot about, I mean, the big picture is really, it's about service. How do you help, you know, whatever's going around you with your hot anvil and, you know, hot iron and anvil and forge, really, you know. It's really not that complicated. Like, you get it hot, hit it hard. And I just took a road trip down to Madison. And one of the things that we discussed was how there's all these little towns every 10 miles. And every 10 miles is about how far a horse could travel loaded in a day. And then they would need new shoes. And so while we travel all over, we have to slow down for all these little towns, right? Every 10 or 12 miles, there was a blacksmith shop serving the needs of whatever it was, wagon hitch or horseshoes or whatever. So, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's morphed over time a bit.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Right. Now there's all different branches. There's different specialties. And everybody has different definitions even of what a blacksmith is.
And I think you, as I looked at your website, you view it as an art form.
Yeah, I do. I use it primarily to create art. Art with, I would call it a small A art. Again, right? You know, so you got your fine arts, and then, so I try to add an aesthetic quality to the tools of our lives. Does that make any sense?
Well, I have looked at some of the things you do, and it looks like pretty nice artwork to me. I mean, talk about what you, before we go to the phones, I know we already have Gary in Madison who wants to make a comment, but what kinds of things do you produce?
Again, it's, you know, it mostly falls, for me, it falls into the line of tools. So it could be a handrail. I just got done making a set of gates. Currently working on a small decorative bridge, but it's a tool to cross a ravine. And so, yeah, it's mostly, I call it architectural. It falls under the heading of an architectural type work. That is what relates to how we live.
Yeah. Gary in Madison, let's give you a chance to join in. Hi, Gary.
Hello. Thanks for taking the call. Yeah, my great-great-grandfather from Sweden opened up a blacksmith shop in Chicago back in the 1800s. And it continued through the family. And in the 70s, after I graduated high school, I went directly to work into the mill, into the forging mill. And I worked on very large,
I drove was probably almost two stories high. That's how tall this was. And we would forge 14-inch billets at 2,100 degrees, making large bars, hexagon bars, discs, rings. And I did that for about 7 years as a young man. And I'll tell you what, that was hot, heavy work. We worked 9 hours a day, 8 hours on Saturday, and it was a very dangerous place.
Yeah, what kind of work specifically did you do there?
Well, I did all of it. I trained to be a blacksmith on one of the hammers. I was a helper on the other side. There was open die forging.
Yeah, okay.
I was a helper on the other side of the end of the die.
Yeah.
You know, and I tell you what, that was a sad.
It was a lot of work from the sound of it.
Yeah, and I bet you that a lot of the things you made are still working today.
Wouldn't doubt it a bit. I wouldn't doubt it a bit. Gary, thanks. So he did it for 7 years. That's a fairly long time. You've been doing it, though, for 30 years or more.
I think, though, that if you took my experience and put it against his, he's probably pounded a ton more iron than I ever dreamed of touching.
Gary, thank you so much for calling. James, how did you get involved in this whole business?
Yeah. You know, I got to give a shout out to Dan Nauman out of Bighorn Forge out of West Bend and Matt Harvey out of Campbellsport. These guys, if you want to learn to be a blacksmith, don't go to the internet for it. Go find a blacksmith to learn from. And both these guys, Dan Nauman and Matt Harvey, they took me under their wing, and then I got real fortunate to have good teachers. And we traveled with this group called ABANA, that's the Artist Blacksmith Association of North America. And they're like the depository for all this old knowledge kind of stuff. And so we don't learn this stuff on our own, right? I had some great teachers, and yeah, that's my shout out to Dan and Matt. Yeah, thanks, guys.
What drew it to you in the first place?
The creativity, really. You know, here's something I figured out. You can take a cubic meter of steel, right? Mm-hmm. A cubic meter of steel, and draw it into a wire so thin that's 5/1000ths of an inch in diameter, and it'll go around the world.
Cubic meter.
A cubic meter of steel drawn to a wire, and you can do it. And then you can ball it all back up and make that same cubic meter of steel again. And to me, that's just phenomenal. That's like the most creative thing any human being could ever imagine doing.
Yeah.
And I love being a part of that process, however small, you know.
I was involved in the... took my daughter Emily when she was much younger. She's 21 now, but she was maybe 8 or 9. We went to the Midwest Fire Fest in Cambridge, Wisconsin.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
And we both got to work with a blacksmith. They were setting up and you could make your own little thing. And I worked with a blacksmith and got to make a bottle opener. And Emily made something else, and I've forgotten what she made. It was a little artistic thing, but it was really fascinating to work with that metal and to have somebody there really to do, you know, step-by-step instruction as we went along. It just made it a lot of fun.
Having somebody to facilitate the learning process.
Yeah. Yeah. Is that something you've done? It sounded maybe this artistic artist blacksmith association has done work like that, or maybe you've been involved in something like that.
Yeah. I teach up at a facility up in Minnesota. Shout out to North House Folk School. And they teach all kinds of hands-on trades, old historic trades. And so I really love teaching because there's just, it's like turning on these little light bulbs. and you know, people get to, it moves the process. I always say, people, we know that the old expression of a picture is worth a thousand words. A demonstration is worth a thousand pictures.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. By the way, that was about 10 years ago. I think I know I still have that bottle opener. It sits on top of my refrigerator.
Yeah. Uh-huh. That's great.
I don't know. So, I mean, what got you interested in this trade in the first place?
Yeah, you know, I think mostly, I mean, my first came from the Foxfire series of books. And that was, you know, I think a lot of people know that reference of Foxfire, you know, and that's where I first read about it. And then it was just always held a fascination because it's one of those things that it's not so easy to just pick up and do. But there's so many different things that you can do with it. So, the utility of it, as an artist, it really just allowed me to express whatever was on my mind. You know, it could be a chisel or a knife or a gate or railing or purely sculptural. You know, it just, for me, it was just a personal connection that, you know, just, it kind of
mushroom.
Feels powerful.
Mushroom, so to speak. James Michael Jones, our guest today. He's been a blacksmith for more than 30 years, owns and operates a custom shop on the Bayfield Peninsula. It's great to have him with us. And questions, comments, or maybe experiences to share, I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at blacksmithing today with our guest, James Michael Jones, blacksmith for more than 30 years, works, has a custom shop that he operates on the Bayfield Peninsula. So, great place to be doing that for sure. Again, an experience or question, give a call at 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. Vernon Boyd had a comment, said that Racine was a hot spot for blacksmithing. You know anything about Racine as a hot spot for blacksmithing, James? He's wondering that.
Actually, one of the, not really Racine, I don't know much about the local Racine and scene in Racine, but Milwaukee actually has was historically the host of Cyril Kulnick. Cyril Kulnick was one of the finest blacksmiths that the world has probably ever seen. And if you can get up to Milwaukee and go see the Cyril Kulnick Museum, yeah, it's jaw dropping. It's amazing what people can do with iron. I don't know so much about Racine, but I do know that you can go to Milwaukee and check out Cyril Kulnick.
Vern, this one in Plain, Wisconsin, called but couldn't stay with us. Drew Alexander in Virginia is a famous blacksmither. He goes around teaching. Okay. Do you know him, James, or work with him ever?
I never met Drew. You know, there's quite a few people out there that, yeah, it's a pretty big, they say it's a lost art, and I say, nope, it's really not. So, yeah, I never heard of Drew Alexander, but maybe I have to look for him.
Dave in Wausau, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Dave.
Well, hi, Larry. You know, this topic is just so fascinating for me. I grew up in a village outside of Milwaukee, Elm Grove, and Watertown Plank Road, which is a pretty well-known road for people down in southeastern Wisconsin. There was a blacksmith shop that was there even into the 60s when I was a kid. And I remember you'd always see the barn door open, and you could hear all of the things that were going on in there. And it was a touch of the past. And yet, you know, there was still the modern part of the village. But you knew that had been there probably for 100 years. And eventually the business closed down, and they built a financial institution where it was. But they have a plaque on that financial building saying former home of the Saunders blacksmith shop, just so that people, you know, can remember that part of the history. But I remember as a kid taking my trike down there because the little seat got broken off, and you took it in and they'd weld it for you, and then off I pedaled and went home.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's that service element again. As I think, you know, a lot of times we wake up between the difference of what I decide I want to do and what other people decide they want me to do. And most days it has to do with, you know, welding seat bikes on, stuff like that, right?
Dave,
so, yeah, thanks for sharing that.
Yeah, Dave, that's great. Thank you so much for calling. Well, I'm wondering about your business. You're in the Bayfield Peninsula.
Yes.
I mean, you must have enough business to keep you going. And you talked about, well, fixing a bike, but what else do you do?
Well, I think the majority of my work has really come from architectural applications, right? I do a lot of, but they're designed around their architectural applications. And so, yeah, I do a lot of gates, quite a few railings, fireplace sets. I did work for the Bayfield Inn and different locations around, and mostly, I wouldn't want to say wealthy, but, well, you know, people that are working with be able to afford my work, and
yeah,
you know, but
keeps you busy.
Yeah I mean, and busy is a relative term. I'm a one-man shop, and there are times when I let the work pile up a bit and do other things. And you know, part of the lifestyle for me has to do with being free to make my own decisions on what I choose and not choose. So, but yeah, it's complicated.
What's the what are the tools? I mean, we know there's, you know, a hammer and anvil, I guess, is associated
there's
with
the
this
hammer and the anvil. I was just up at the shop today, or I'm working up there right now, and we have a poem of in the blacksmith from Francis Whitaker. He said, if the eye can't see it, the hand can't make it. And if the tongs can't hold it, the hammer can't hit it. So tongs is really one of those unsung heroes of the blacksmith shop. So you got your hammer, your anvil, and your tongs. I bring a mechanical hammer, sort of small versions of the industrial type of hammer to the work, and modern welding and stuff like that. But hammer, anvil, and tongs.
But you need some fire, don't you?
Well, then you get your fire on that. Yes, right, exactly. Exactly, yeah. I use a lot of gas. I burn propane in a larger forge. And then I also have solid fuel. It's either charcoal or coal. And a lot of modern blacksmiths are using induction forging. They're actually using the same technology that we use in induction stoves and stuff. So three different heat sources.
And there are, you start with a piece of metal. I understand.
Yep.
And there's like 8 different paths
or right.
That you can take with that metal. Give us a couple of examples, perhaps.
Sure. Well, first step is to draw things out. We can make it longer and longer and longer, and the point becomes thinner and thinner and thinner. And then we can upset things and push back on them. It takes a lot more energy to upset things than it does to draw them out. Then we can bend things. We can, you know, take a straight thing and make it curved, or we could take a curved thing and make it straight. And then that's right. I mean, it's very simple stuff. You know, it's like ABCs. We can cut things, and we can cut them all the way off or not all the way off, and punch a hole right through things. Outside of that, then becomes some twisting we can do and welding. We can join things. You know, take 1 + 1 = 1 sort of thing. And then we can heat treat things. We can make them things harder or softer. And that's about 8 things. I didn't have my list in front of me, but that's
about
the
it.
Top of my head. Yeah, that's about it. That's all you can do. You know, it's like ABCs of blacksmithing. So then we create short sentences, and we create chapters, and we create verse and rhythm and sounds, put all those things in there.
Sounds kind of philosophical.
We do get a little philosophical. It's one of the things I enjoy a lot about the process. I can put a lot of my mind into it. And yeah, exactly. It's a lot of fun that way.
I was thinking back to my day, or my, it wasn't a whole day, but it was my time, let's put it in my daughter's time, when we were at the Midwest Fire Fest in Cambridge.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we just showed up. I had my normal clothes and all that, and the blacksmith that was working with me was much better prepared. And kind of took over some parts that were, you know, where there was some danger involved, because it can be dangerous. You have special clothing or, you know, and that sort of thing that you use?
I try to. I mean, I wear glasses because I need them in my daily life. I do wear, because I do it so often, I'll wear earmuffs, and I'll wear a respirator if I feel like I'm kicking up a lot of dust. We try not to wear gloves, although, you know, again, it's a lot of time, you know, dependent upon the actual task, I guess. And but mostly, you know, I think, you know, we don't really need full protective gears, but a lot of it depends. Are you making little hooks, or are you doing production forging of large squirrels and stuff? But I do use PPEs.
Do you teach blacksmithing at the North House Folk School?
Yeah.
That you must get some enjoyment and fun from that.
I love it. Yeah, there's nothing like sharing something that you love with people that want to learn it, right? You know?
Yeah, of course.
I mean, maybe some people don't see it that way, but for me, it's like I said before, like going around turning on these little light bulbs, and there's so much that a person can learn when they can ask the question. And when they, you know, it's one thing to watch the video of some expert making a knife. It's another thing to have an expert watching you make the knife and saying, oh, well, if you just did this a little bit, or, oh, if you change the way you're holding this, or, oh, if you can pull this out now and make this move. The learning curve goes flat, you know, rather than just like hitting a wall, right?
Well, I tell you what, it's been fun talking to you. And we have a link on our website to that class. James, thank you so much for being with us today. Really appreciate it. And we will talk again at some point with James Michael Jones, blacksmith for more than 30 years. He works out of his custom shop on the Bayfield Peninsula. Thank you for joining us today. We got a team effort here. Clara Kniper, Joel Patnod, Lee Rayburn, and Jeff Robbins, our executive producer, Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller, and stay with us. Lots more in store on WPR News.
And his wife, and it's Sparks.